So in two previous messages, we looked at seven reasons that God gave us the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder. And the first we learned that murder subverts God's authority over life and over death. Second, murder harms people, even those who might think they're only protecting themselves. Third, murder facilitates lust. Most often we kill when we desire to have something someone else has and we don't. Fourth, murder defiles us and those around us. It makes us filthy, of low estate. It perverts our thinking. Fifth, murder is rooted in hate. Murder starts out in wrong thoughts that become wrong actions. Sixth, murder is contrary to God's image and name, which is love. And seventh, murder goes against who God is and what his plan for us is, which is life. God wants to give us life. So knowing all this, how is it that some come to the conclusion that God condones military action? And what should our view as Christians be of military service? The answer should be obvious, and yet when we look at the Bible as a whole, there is room for confusion. Many in mainstream Christianity see military service as an exception to the sixth commandment. And they might even say that military killing is just that. It's killing and not murder. Does God separate the two? And is military service an example of the former? The argument that military work is an acceptable service for Christians to perform rests primarily on this premise, that scriptures abound with accounts of people who have professed to follow God, who served military and killed enemy combatants. Well, let's sum. Abraham, Moses, Saul, David, the nation of Israel, all these men went to battle at one time or another. Now, one thing we should note here is that all of these are Old Testament examples. We do not find accounts of Christians fighting for warring nations in the New Testament. Still, it's important to know what's going on in the Old Testament. Did circumstances change? Did God change his law? Is the law circumstantial? Does God approve of war in some circumstances and for some people, but not for others? So let's begin by going back to our list of why God tells us not to murder. And let's apply this list specifically to military service. So first of all, we had murder subverts God's authority. We decide who gets to live and die rather than God. So unless God has willed us into battle, then we most certainly are going against his authority, taking life where God has given it. Second, murder harms people. Well, obviously, war harms people. It takes away people's lives. It destroys their homes and their families. Third, murder facilitates lust. What are the reasons for war? James told us that war comes from lust reigning in our members. So wars among nations are fought generally over resources and land, and sometimes, in a more ethereal sense, over power. If we were to list off each of the major wars the United States has been involved in since its founding, we'd see that lust played a part in each one. Lust to control or set our own government, our own laws, and our own taxation. Both the Civil War and the Revolutionary War essentially revolved around this. Lust to have land that belongs to another, the Mexican-American War. Lust to maintain power among the nations, which would describe many of our wars of the 20th century. Think of even a so-called good war like World War II. We tend to think of atrocities committed by the losing side, by Germany and Japan. But, in fact, it was Britain that first bombed German civilians. The Germans did not start off bombing the British civilians. That was a retaliation. On the other hand, the British bombed German civilians because Germany had bombed Polish civilians. Germany invaded Poland and other nations to avenge a treaty that had severely punished it after World War I. And so it goes back, farther and farther back, generation to generation, one thing for another, a string of revengeful actions. So does beating another nation down so badly that it thinks twice before attacking again work? Well, after World War II, we have another example. The United States, wanting to discourage communist parties from gaining power in the nations of Europe that it had just conquered, created the Marshall Plan, which gave and lent money to those nations to help them rebuild. quite a difference from World War I. And the result, arguably one reason that the whole of Europe has not gone to war as quickly as it had in the 100 years previous, is that World War II did not end with the victors trying to reap revenge on the conquered, but rather with the victors helping the conquered rebuild. Fourth, murder defiles us and those around us. So what is war often accompanied by? Well, not just murder, but raping and pillaging, sexual sins and stealing. So when one of the main moral rules that reign our basis nature is done away with, as in war, most other moral rules soon fall also. Fifth, murder is rooted in hate. How many go to war against their friends? No, instead, our enemies in battle are, in fact, dehumanized. They become something less than us, less deserving of life, something less than human, less human than we ourselves are. The Nazis called the Jews rats. The Hutus called the Tutsis cockroaches. The pseudoscience of eugenics claimed to place races in a hierarchy and justified the unequal treatment of black Americans in this country. And to an extent, the science itself postdated the obliteration of the Native Americans as Europeans moved across the continent. We send our sons and daughters off to war, our various young men, with protestations about how we must bring civilization to savage nations. We place ourselves on a level above the enemy, and then we're surprised when those same young people do things like urinate on corpses of the enemy or take pictures of enemy prisoners in dog collars. And this leads us to the sixth reason that God hates murder, that it goes against God's image and name. When we dehumanize our fellow human beings, we are essentially saying that that person is not in God's image, that we somehow deserve more than the person next to us. We are human, we are of God, but the enemy is not. The enemy is of the cockroaches or the rats. Finally, murder goes against life, which is what God himself said. War is the opposite of life. Rather, war renders death on a massive scale. As Robert J. Oppenheimer stated, when the first test of the atomic bomb went off with some success, quoting the Bhagavad Gita, "I become death, the destroyer of worlds." Who, after all, is the originator of war? Was it not Satan who convinced a third of the angels to rise up and to attempt to throw off God on his throne? When we participate in war, we are participating in a system that was brought into being by the destroyer of this universe. And when we do that, whose image then do we take on? So clearly, killing within the context of military service doesn't exempt us from the evils that are murder. And as such, it would not seem that God would approve of humans participating in the military. And yet we find those scriptures in the Old Testament, those many examples of the ancient Israel and its leaders going to battle. How is it that God condoned these actions when his own law stated, in no uncertain terms, that it is wrong to murder our fellow human being? In this case, circumstance really does matter. One thing we must note to begin with is that God did not necessarily condone Israel's warfare, but rather allowed it. The scriptures include many stories that are not accompanied by a commentary about the right or wrong of the action, or that focus on another aspect of someone's behavior. Let's go for an example of this to Joshua 2. Joshua 2, we're going to look verses 8 through 14. The lead up to the fall of Jericho, a prostitute named Rahab took in two spies from the children of Israel and hid them from the men who were searching for them. And in the process, she lied to the researchers in order to protect the spies. Many people have used this as a justification for why it is okay to lie in some circumstances. But is this the lesson that God wants us to glean from this story? Did God commend Rahab for lying? Is he telling us that it's okay to lie if the situation really demands it? So let's go to the scripture and let's look at what she was praised for. Joshua 2, verses 8 through 14. And before they were laid down, she came up unto them upon the roof, and she said unto them, unto the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side of Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. Now therefore, I pray you, swear unto me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show kindness unto my father's house and give me a true token, and that you will save alive my father and my mother and my brethren and my sisters and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. And the men answered her, our life for yours, if you utter not this our business. And it shall be, when the Lord has given us the land, the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you. So first of all, let's note, the deal here for Rahab's life is made not between God and Rahab, but between Rahab and the two spies. But God honored the deal that was made, just as he had Israel honor the deal that they had made with the Jebusites, a people God had told the Israelites to wipe out, but who tricked the Israelites by pretending to be people from far away into allowing them to live in exchange for being servants. Second, in Hebrews 11 and verse 31, Paul commends Rahab not for lying, but for faith. He says in Hebrews 11, 31, by faith the harlot Rahab perished, not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. So it was her belief, her understanding, that the God of Israel had delivered the nation that saved her. She believed in God. She believed enough that she was willing to give up life among her own people to become an Israelite. She wasn't going to continue living as she had among the inhabitants of Jericho. She was going to take on a new religion, a new culture, a new God. And the lesson we're taking from this story is one of turning away from false gods toward the true. Not that under certain circumstances it's okay to lie. Let's go to another example of something that doesn't receive a lot of commentary, but it's an example of something that, hey, this person does something not too smart. Let's go to Judges 11, verses 30 through 39. Jephthah went out to fight for the children of Ammon on behalf of the Israelites. Wanting to ensure victory, he made a vow unto God. Let's pick it up now in verse 30. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, if you shall without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that that whatsoever comes forth out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. So Jephthah passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord delivered them into his hands, and he smote them from Aroer even till you come to Minnith, even 20 cities, and unto the plain of the vineyards with a very great slaughter. So thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. And Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances, and she was his only child beside her. He had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he rent his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are one of them that troubles me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back. And she said to him, my father, if you have opened your mouth unto the Lord, do to me according to that which has proceeded out of your mouth, for as much as the Lord has taken vengeance for you of your enemies, even the children of Ammon. And she said unto her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, and I may go up and down the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. And he said, go. And he sent her away for 2 months. And she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. And it came to pass at the end of the 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow. which he had vowed, and she knew no man, and it was a custom in Israel. So what are we to take from this example? Are we to conclude that it is okay to sacrifice one's children, even though God says that he hates child sacrifice? We don't read what lesson we are to draw from this scripture here. Now, whether Jephthah actually offered his daughter up as a burnt offering, an offering of dedication, that is, or simply dedicated her to godly service, and thus to lifelong celibacy, is another question which we won't get into here. Either way, we cannot think that this would have been what God would have originally intended for Jephthah's daughter or of one of his servants. In terms of the lessons we are to draw in other passages, of course, we read that Jesus says that we shouldn't make vows. And certainly we should be careful of what kind of vow we make if we do. But when we look at the book of Judges itself, the point that the author makes over and over in this book, including in the very last verse of this book, is that in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So the book tells of the decline of Israel after Joshua and the elders died, as it constantly fell from God and had to be restored multiple times. But if you read the book from start to finish, you'll also note an almost continual decline in the moral values, and you can see this particularly in the way that women are treated in Israel. The nation seems to be falling farther and farther away from God, farther and farther away from treating women in a right way. Jephthah, as judge, falls somewhere in the middle of the book and of this decline. Another point, then, of this passage, then, illustrates how far Israel was falling away from God and the tragedy of it. So when we come to the examples of warfare among the followers of God in the Old Testament, we have to realize that such was not necessarily what God willed, but he did allow it. So let's go to Exodus 14, verses 13 through 14. And note here that I'm pulling a lot of this material, a lot of this forthcoming discussion here, from Mr. Armstrong's book on military service and war. Here we are at the time that God freed Israel from Egypt in Exodus 14. And all during the struggle, God did everything for Israel. He sent the 10 plagues on Egypt, destroying its agricultural resources and eventually much of the nation itself. And when Pharaoh went in pursuit of Israel after giving them permission to leave, God led them on an obscure route away from the Egyptian army in order that they would not see battle. But Pharaoh caught up with them. And listen here to what Moses said in verses 13 and 14 of chapter 14 of Exodus. And Moses said unto the people, "Fear you not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you shall see them no more, see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And of course, soon after this, God opened up the Red Sea and led Israel through it, and then closed it upon the army itself. So God fought for Israel, even as he promised that he would do here. There was no murder on the part of the people involved. God's protection extended over Israel. And this is what God intended. Let's go to Exodus 23. Exodus 23, we're going to read verses 20 through 23. Here we're going to see that God promised to take care of Israel's enemies. God himself promised this. Israel wasn't going to have to do any fighting. God would do it for them. Exodus 23, verses 20 through 23. "And behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you shall indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto your enemies and an adversary unto your adversaries. For my angel shall go before you." He'll go before you and bring you in unto the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. I, God, will cut them off. So God would cut off the people who were at that moment living in the promised land. He would clear the land for them. Now let's go to Numbers 33. Numbers 33. We're going to see, we're going to notice a change here. We're going to be in verses 50 through 53. This is sometime later. The children of Israel have been wandering around in the wilderness for a while at this point, and they're now on the border of this land. Spies have gone into the land and looked at the land God is to give them. And notice here what they say in Numbers 33, verses 50 through 53. And the Lord spoke unto Moses in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho. He says here, speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when you are passed over Jordan unto the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their pictures and destroy all their molten images and quite pluck down all their high places. And you shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell therein, for I have given you the land to possess it. So we have something going on here different. God says that Israel is to drive out the inhabitants and to destroy the people now. He's transferred the job to them rather than saying that he would do it to them. What changed? What elicited this change of heart? Why would God now give the task to Israel of clearing the land and even say, dare say it, go to war? What elicited this change was the fact that Israel failed to believe God. So let's go to Deuteronomy 1, verses 26 through 32. Time and again, Israel opted to rely on its own resources, on human sight. God had plagued Egypt. He had wiped out the army with the Red Sea. He had done this for Israel. And yet, when there was a lack of water, the people complained. When there was a lack of meat, the people complained. When enemies came against them, the people gathered their swords together and they went out to defend themselves. And they asked Moses, why did you do this to us? Why did you, Moses, do this to us? Bring us out here to die. They looked to Moses and to a man rather than looking to God, despite all that God had done. And note what God said here to Israel in recounting events in Deuteronomy 1, verses 26 through 32. Notwithstanding, you would not go up, but rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us, he has brought us forth out of the land of Egypt to deliver us unto the hand of the Amorites and to destroy us. Whither shall we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people is greater and taller than we. The cities are great and walled up to heaven. And moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakims there. And I said unto them, I said unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God, which goes before you, he shall fight for you according to all that he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness where you have seen how the Lord your God has bore you, as a man does bear his son in all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet in this thing you did not believe the Lord your God. So God told Israel time and time again that he would do for them in Canaan as he had done for them in Egypt. He would take care of the inhabitants. But when Israel got to the border, what did they do? The 12 spies sent in said in Numbers 13:39, we will not be able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than us. Okay? What did it have to do with them? God said he would give them the land. They didn't look to God, but to their own battlements. Even back in Exodus 17, verses 8 and 9. Let's go to Exodus 17, verses 8 and 9. Israel was already making the choice to rely on their own might. In the beginning of the chapter, we have the account of Israel's complaints about the water. And that's the first big complaint that we see, the first temptation of God that he talks about, the 10 times have you tempted me. And about whom do they complain? Well, they complain, as I said before, about Moses, not about God. And so when shortly thereafter Amalek comes against them, Moses, tired of their complaining, instructs them to go out and to fight. So Exodus 17, verses 8 and 9, he says, then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. And yet this story also shows how God helped Israel, even when Israel itself chose to fight. Israel made a decision to fight, and God in turn respected that decision, even if it was not his original will. Now, if we go back to that very first reason that I presented for why God doesn't want us to murder, we'll note something else there that applies in this situation in the Old Testament and in other similar situations. The first reason God told us not to murder was that God reserves for himself authority over life and death matters. He is the one who judges. He is the one who chooses who shall die and when. When we take that authority upon ourselves, we subvert that which is God's. By extension, what this means is that God can, if he decides, transfer that authority over life and death to human beings. And that is what he sometimes did in the Old Testament. Let's look first at the famous example of Abraham, who was told to sacrifice his son. Let's go to Genesis 22. Genesis 22, verses 1 through 2. Abraham is known as the father of the faithful, but here God commands him to take a life and in fact to sacrifice a child, something that God elsewhere states that he hates. What were most child sacrifices for? At that time, they were to serve pagan gods, specifically the god Moloch. Nowadays, the child sacrifice, known as abortion, is most often committed to serve the god of self. So what's convenient for me? What can I afford in terms of time and money and reputation? But Abraham here is asked to sacrifice for the true God. Genesis 22, verses 1 through 2. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and get you into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon the mountains which I will tell you of. So here it is, God who commands Moses to do this thing. But for what goal does God command this? Does he really want the life of Isaac? Well, or does he really want the life of Abraham? Well, actually, the answer is yes. He does want Isaac's life, and he does want Abraham's life. He wants to see that Abraham truly will obey him above all else. He wants a living sacrifice. So let's drop down to verse 12. And he said, Lay not your hand upon the lad, neither do you anything unto him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So that was God's point. God didn't require Isaac's life in the form of killing, but he had the authority to ask for it. Abraham was not the creator. Of course, he did not have the authority of his own to sacrifice his son. And he certainly not for himself. So we can say the same for Israel on some level. God told Israel to clear the land of its inhabitants. And in doing that, he had reasons that were beyond simply handing Israel property that was someone else's. Let's go to Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18. We're going to look at verses 24 through 28. In this chapter, God recounts a series of sins that he wants Israel to avoid. He does this in other passages as well. And here, it's the sexual sins that he mostly talks about. In other places, he lists sins relating to idol worship and to religious practices. The inhabitants of the land of Canaan were a degenerate bunch. So here we have, in Leviticus 18, verses 24 through 28, a description. Defile not you yourselves in any of these things, for in all these things the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomits out her inhabitants. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourns among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spewed not you out also when you defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. So God's purpose here was to dispossess the Canaanites of the land that they inhabited. He wanted these perverse people wiped out before they could spread that perversion elsewhere. God then gave that land to the Israelites. Originally, he had denoted that he would clear the land for the Israelites. But because Israel chose to rely on themselves, chose to fight, God stepped back and let Israel do the work. God's purpose to clear the land was still to be achieved, and now Israel became the tool by which he did it, rather than just the recipient of the blessing of the land. So we began this message by looking at seven reasons that God commands us not to murder. First, because it subverts God's authority. Second, because it harms people, even those who might think that they are only protecting themselves. Third, because it facilitates lust. We kill because we desire something someone else has. Fourth, because it defiles us and those around us. It perverts our thinking. Fifth, because it is rooted in hate. Sixth, because it is contrary to God's image and name, which is love. And seventh, because it goes against God, who God is, and what his plan for us, which is life. We then looked at how murder within the parameters of war still generally leads to the same results. And from this we can glean that God does not excuse us from the law for the sake of military service. And yet, as many will point out, the Bible has many examples of the people of God going to battle in the Old Testament. These examples are used as a basis by many for arguing for why it is okay to kill in the context of war. But how are we to see such examples? As we've seen, we have to be careful what lessons we draw from the Old Testament examples, most especially when historical peoples did something contrary to God's law and were not explicitly condemned for it. We are reading history, and just because someone who in the Bible did something and is acclaimed as being righteous doesn't mean that those particular sins are being condoned. God allows people to do bad things, to choose to do right and to do wrong. We then looked at the example of ancient Israel, which fought many wars, many of them in God's name, and saw that God's original intent was not for Israel to fight, but that God allowed the nation to do so. And in doing so, God has Israel fulfill his will, namely to remove a perverse people from the land of Canaan. Israel murdered in this sense by God's authority. And even so, even having that authority, this did not excuse Israel from the price that they would pay for the punishment of the Canaanites that God had originally reserved for himself. And that price is something that we're going to look at in a future message.